from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Nationally syndicated political columnist Molly Ivins looked out at the world last week, and this is what she saw. Politicians outraged over Bill Clinton's affair, making light of nasty sex charges against Arnold Schwarzenegger. Right-wingers disgusted by celebrities expressing political opinions, happily saddling up with the Terminator as governor. Professional patriots poo-pooing an apparent White House leak exposing a CIA agent that would have had a Democrat fried and fricasseed. And that's just for starters. Never mind the rich getting richer, the democracy getting poorer, and George W. Bush getting Molly Ivins' goat at every turn. Ivins has covered Texas politics since 1970. In her last book, Shrub, she warned the nation against G.W. Bush's legacy in the Lone Star State. Now she turns to the words of the old Republican warhorse Bob Dole to ask the nation, where is the outrage? Tonight on Point, progressive Texan and national columnist Molly Ivins on her old governor and the American president. Molly Ivins is mad. Do you buy the Molly Ivins critique? Does her whacking of the president make you cheer or make you mad? And if she's wrong about Bush, where is she wrong? And if she's right about the president, why are his poll numbers inching back up? Why don't we hear more alarm in the media? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Austin, Texas, is Molly Ivins, nationally syndicated columnist and author with Lou DeBose of Bushwhacked, Life in George W. Bush's America. Good evening and welcome, Molly Ivins.
Thank you. How nice to be with y'all.
It's great to be with you. Molly Ivins, Shrub had a lot of humor in it. You've got some humor in Bushwhacked as well, but a lot more anger by my lights. And when I get to the very last page of the book, it looks to me like you're coming out really swinging here, saying that Bush's administration is fascist.
Well, Neil, I hardly ever in 35 years of writing about politics have I used the F word, but sometimes I think we're skirting dangerously close to it here. I must say I am angry about what Bush is doing to the country. But I wanted to make a distinction. I keep getting people who say, well, you're just another Bush hater. Actually, I've known George W. for a real long time, since we were both in high school. I'm not a Bush hater. I think that grown-ups can actually make the distinction between somebody in public office and who he or she might be and policies that actually harm people. I don't think it's that tough to make that distinction. And just to say that you think that George W. is a disastrous president doesn't mean that you're a Bush hater.
And I don't think we're not jumping off to slam you into that category. We're very interested in what you've got to say. It's a big book with a lot of detail in it, but it does come down to a pretty high voltage conclusion here. You quote Mussolini. You say Mussolini said, fascism should more properly be called corporatism, since it is the merger of state and corporate power. And then you write, that's pretty much what we're looking at here, and the results are not good for the people of this country. That's pretty hot, Molly Ivins.
Yeah, it is. And I do think that definition of fascism by Mussolini is very much to the point. Not that Bush is, you know, set out to be some black shirt kind of person, but he honestly believes, and it's an old motto of Texas government, that the purpose of government is a healthy business climate. And down here in Texas, people have believed that for generations, and so government consists of doing nothing but helping big corporations get rich and ignore regulations and not have any restraints put on them. And here's O.W. taking the whole package up to the national capital, and there's an old country song, Lubbock on Everything. Well, it's looking to me more and more like we've got Texas on everything in this country, and here W. is taking what he did to Texas, which wasn't good, and taking it national.
You call it, you say, this is open class warfare. This country is not working for most of the people in it. The health care system is falling apart. The social safety net has been shredded. The Bushies want to privatize Social Security and the schools. So is that the critique? Is class war the charge you're making here, Molly Ivins?
Well, I think it is. You could certainly define it that way. But what Lou and I did, Lou DeBose, my writing partner and I, for years I've thought that the media pay too much attention to the Dow Jones average. Nobody really knows what that number means, but it's on television every day, and it takes up acres in the newspaper. And what we really need in this country is the Doug Jones average. That would be Doug Jones, average American. How's old Doug doing? Is he up? Is he down? How's Doug today? And this book was our attempt to go out and find out how the Doug Jones average was setting. And what we found was pretty much bad across the board, not just lost jobs. But that's part of it. It's lost pensions, lost health insurance doubling and tripling in prices, lost overtime, lost organizing rights. I mean, you can just go on and on. I mean, the people out there are not doing well under George W. Bush.
And what's your analysis of why things are not going well for the people that you talk to?
I really think that Bush has been following that old Texas idea that you just help business, and business are your friends and your contributors. And so it works for him politically. It's not as though he were being paid off to do something he doesn't believe in. He honestly thinks that what we need to do is, you know, make corporations fatter and more profitable, and then everything will go along hunky-dory. And frankly, it doesn't work. I really think that we've reached such a point that we have not democracy in this country, but a kind of corporate oligarchy ruled by the wealthy, where you have a government of special interests for corporate special interests and by corporate special interests. And that's not going to change until we change the way campaigns are financed.
Give us the chapter and verse, as you see it, Molly, on how that corporate power is expressed in this administration. I mean, corporations have been powerful in America for a long time. What's the special expression of that power or evidence of it that you see this time out?
Okay, well, let me make one thing clear. I'm not saying this as a partisan thing. It seems to me the Democrats are just as ruined and just as corrupted by this system of campaign financing as the Republicans are. But one certainly sees it clearly with the Bush people. Just for one example, when they came in, they killed off a plan for ergonomic regulations to prevent repetitive stress injuries for mm-hmm. people who work on assembly lines and do the same thing over and over all day. And that was set to go. That had been started by Elizabeth Dole, well-known communist, of course, back when she was head of the Department of Labor and worked on for 12 years in that interminable government process where everybody sits at the table. The doctors were there. The labor unions were there. The manufacturers were there. Everybody got their say. They all finally agree on a set of regulations to prevent this repetitive stress stuff. And wham, the minute Bush gets in, he just kills it dead. And that's, of course, because the man, in fact, he named the chief lobbyist, the man who had been paid huge sums over the years to work at killing off these regulations, was the guy Bush named the top lawyer at the Department of Labor. It was kind of like a cruelty joke.
Mm-hmm.
And then Lou and I, in our book, went and traced that. We were interested in how this affects average people. Went down to Belzoni, Mississippi, talked to a bunch of women there who work in the Delta Pride catfish factory, mm-hmm. and they have to do 12 fish a minute. And by many of them, they don't all get this condition, but by the time they're 30, many of them have hands that look like they have rheumatoid arthritis.
Gnarled.
And they have these huge knots on the back of their wrists called gangliatic cysts. Mm-hmm. You can get the condition corrected by surgery, but if you go back on the cut-and-gut line, it'll just come back worse. And we were talking to these women. Now, they had never heard of, the lobbyist up in Washington. Actually, they'd never even heard of ergonomics. They had no idea anybody was trying to help with mm-hmm. this condition. And we tell them about it, and naturally good white liberals that Lou and I are, we'd gone down there to play the dirge on the violin mm-hmm. for these hapless victims of a misbegotten policy. Well, these ladies were so tough and so funny and so feisty. And their response was, huh, huh. They'd hold up these twisted hands and say, he think this be junk science? He said this be junk science? Well, you tell that man I want his ass next to me on the cut and gut line. Mm-hmm. I'll show him some junk science. I will show him. I mean, they were fabulous. And everywhere we went, we had the same experience. We couldn't find any average, ordinary, everyday Americans. We just kept finding exceptional people.
You write that Americans remain, in spite of what you see as a kind of onslaught. You say they remain tough, funny, sassy, brave, smart, and full of fight. But you also write, Molly, you say Americans under Bush are not doing well. In fact, they're losing by every economic and quality of life measurement known to man. This country no longer works for the benefit of most of the people in it. Tell us more. What else did you see out there?
Well, one of the things that seems to me more important than specific losses and you can look at income, you can look at class divisions, you can look at it in all kinds of ways with statistics until your eyes water. But I think what is gradually being taken away that's more important than anything else is our sense that we're all in this together, that there is such a thing as a common good, But it's not, you know, if I get this, you don't get something. Or, you know, it's one or the other. We all have to make a choice. The idea that everybody does better when everybody does better doesn't seem to be part of the Bush administration's thinking pattern.
But you know as well as I do that the argument is that when the economy, when business is treated well, the economy booms and all boats rise and take off the shackles and let the free market be the free market.
Well, we've watched people try to do trickle-down economics before, and it sure hadn't worked, and it's not working this time either. And they gave these huge tax cuts to the wealthiest people in the country on the theory that they would invest the money and then more plants would open. Well, that's, again, classic supply-side economics. The trouble is, if you say you own four factories and one of them is shut down because there's not enough demand, it really doesn't help anything if you get a big enough tax cut to open a fifth factory because there's still no demand. That's why those tax cuts should have gone to working-class and middle-class people. You know, the baby's home and needs shoes. They'll go right out and spend it. That's what the economy needs.
So in a democracy, Molly Ivins, if the policy is not about making the people better off and winning their votes next time around, what's it about?
Well, it seems to me there's been a fair amount of misleading people. The tax cuts were sold, as you may recall, they were going to benefit everybody. Every taxpayer was going to get a cut. The average American was going to get $1,000. All that was just hooey.
People did get checks.
Most people didn't get tax cuts, and most of the ones who did didn't get much. It was the people at the top, and I mean the very top. The richest 1% of the people in this country made off with the great bulk of the tax relief. And they're not people who needed tax cuts to begin with.
So what, you know George W. Bush, what do you think he's after here?
I really think that he's like a true believer in the idea that, you know, the free market rules. If you just take all the shackles of government off and let the free market run, then everything will be better. But it seems to me that all our experience with capitalism in this country is that you have to have, for capitalism to work, you have to have regulated capitalism. And I think, for example, the whole collapse of Enron, WorldCom, that whole mess, is a perfect example of what happens when you just have unleashed capitalism, uncontrolled capitalism. Those regulations that Enron carefully bought into being repealed, and I say the word advisedly with their campaign contributions, there was a reason for them to be there in the first place.
There was a reason for the regulations, and when they were gone,
Enron ran amok. Just ran amok.
But
and I don't think it was even that Ken Lay is such a terrible person or really evil-minded. I think a lot of those corporate guys do what they do, not even out of malice or even greed. I think it's because they can. They know they can get away with it.
What do you think George W. Bush's ideal America looks like then, Molly?
Well, you know, I'm sure he wants the best for everybody. And again, I'm not a Bush hater. I don't consider him either stupid or mean. But I do think that he is very limited in his vision. He is very Texas-identified, and much unlike his daddy, who was, you know, an upper-class elite Eastern WASP kind of guy.
Yep.
W is really a Texan and identified with the state culturally, so that you see three strands which are very common in Texas: religiosity, anti-intellectualism, and machismo. And they're all sort of attractive to large clumps of voters. And I think when you take those three strands in Texas culture, which largely shape his personality, and add the most extraordinary class blinkers, Bush is not opposed to poor people. He doesn't see them. I mean, he really has no idea what most people's lives are like. He had been governor of Texas for 6 years, was running for president, when once again the annual statistics came out from the Department of Agriculture saying that Texas was once again number one in hunger. Well, that's been true ever since the Department of Agriculture started keeping numbers on this, because we have, you know, the bottom third of the state.
Yep.
The Rio Grande Valley is one of the poorest places in America. Well, Bush went into a wall-eyed fit. He sat there saying, he thought it was the Clinton people trying to make him look bad. And he said very angrily, well, don't you think the governor would know if there were hunger in this state? There's no hunger in this state. How did they say that?
And Molly Ivins says he wouldn't know. Molly Ivins, we've got to take a short break. We'll be right back. We're talking with Molly Ivins about the former governor of Texas, the nation's president, George W. Bush. Is she right or wrong? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with progressive Texan and national columnist Molly Ivins about her former governor and the nation's president, George W. Bush. Her new book is Bushwhacked, Life in George W. Bush's America. She's written it with Lou DeBose. You can join the conversation with Molly Ivins. Is she right about Bush, or is she wrong? If she's wrong, where? And if she's right, why don't we hear more criticism like this in the media? Do you agree that the country's being handed over to the rich, or is Molly Ivins just afraid of free markets, afraid of freedom? And what about the Molly Ivins F word here, fascism? Is there truth there, or is it way out of line? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Chuck is calling from Marlborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Chuck. You're on the air.
Well, hi. How are you doing?
Great, thanks.
Hey, Molly, I'm a big fan. You know, I've been a fan for many, many years, and I don't want to say many years, but I've been a big fan. And I just wanted to bring in my own point here about George Bush. I am struck, I think, by the callowness of this man, this bring him on bravado, this whole idea that, you know, when somebody from France or Germany wants to go in and get a contract rebuilding some aspect of Iraqi society, Bush treats them like, you know, this is our prize. We want it, and we're going to take it, and we're going to use it. And as you say, I mean, we've pointed out, you've already pointed out some of the sort of business aspects. And I don't know whether you call that non-caring, but it is certainly a studied ignorance.
Chuck, let me ask you, that callowness, does it take you to the point that Molly Ivins has arrived at of real profound alarm about the direction of the country, or do you still see it within kind of the ballpark that American politics are typically played in?
You know, this is a hell of a good country, and we're pretty resilient. But I think this guy has taken us in a direction where nobody wanted to go, and I think that's the alarm that I feel that in fact we're moving too far in a direction that's extreme and just out of the mainstream. You know, some people might say that my being from Massachusetts is
out of the mainstream already.
Out of the mainstream already, but I really consider myself as kind of a moderate. I voted for Republicans. I voted for Democrats.
And this isn't where you wanted to go, Chuck. Thanks very much for your call, and we hear your kudos to Molly Ivins. What about this idea, Molly Ivins?
Well,
this is where nobody wanted to go. I mean, there's a debate over who won, but he got a lot of votes.
I think he's got something. I would have just one hesitation, a little ambivalence on the, you know, bring them on kind of stuff. I realize that sounds dreadful, and his language is so far from diplomacy, it's just painful.
Well, and a lot of American kids have died since he said that.
I know. Tell me. It was so ill-advised. But I am enough of a Texan so that right after September 11th, when he said we're going to smoke them out and round them up, you know, bring them back dead or alive, it didn't even register with me. I am so accustomed to that language that I was sitting there and said, hey, sign me up for the posse, Sheriff.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an extent to which I discount some of the Texian language. I think Chuck's larger point is absolutely correct, though. Among other things, not only is the man not gifted diplomatically, his bad manners, the way he has been treating some of our oldest friends is simply bad manners. It's appalling. And to see it carried through at the level of international diplomacy, which, you know, really doesn't require a whole lot more than huge amounts of fudge factor, is just painful. To deliberately aggravate people who have supported us for so long.
But what if he profoundly disagrees or feels that he disagrees with their view of the world, that he or the people around him think that, you know, it's time to step up and do something big here, and they just don't get it, and they're all tied up in their contracts and everything else. They're not going to do the right thing. America's got to cut through the underbrush. You know that line.
Well, I do know that line, but it obviously was folly to go into a second war in Iraq without international backing. I mean, here we are stuck with the total tab in the embarrassing position of having to go back to the United Nations. And I must say, rather than eat humble pie, if there was any humble pie in that speech, I missed it. I didn't think there was a bite full. And here we are trying to get these people to help us pay for this now. And I am talking about close, good neighbors like Canada. I mean, how you could... It is so difficult to get Canadians stirred up. I assure you, their national motto up there is actually, let's not get excited. but they were just enraged because they were treated so shabbily.
And what about this matter of degree? The alarm that you talk about, and again, even bringing out the word very tentatively, but nevertheless, fascism, this suggests you're putting off the full fire alarm here. Does that mean that there's something going on in a degree that it has not before, and what?
Well, I think it really is the marriage of government and corporations to an extent we haven't seen before. And nobody anywhere in the political spectrum, I think, is so silly that they don't know that big money has an undue influence in politics and has for some time, and is irrespective of party. You know, money talks, bull walks, old saying, very cute. But it has now reached such a point that I'm not sure we have a functioning democracy.
What's the evidence of that, Molly Evans?
Well, I see policy for sale pretty much across the board. And that was the interesting thing about going in and looking at the administration in stories that never made the headlines, never got any airtime on radio or TV. I mean, we're looking at policy changes that were in the form of executive orders, little regulatory changes, little budget cut, and the extraordinary difference they have made in people's lives is what's so amazing. And the other part is how few people make the connection between what's going wrong in their lives and the people making the decisions in Washington.
Give us some examples of this intersection of corporate interest and under-the-radar changes that are affecting people.
Well, there was one. I mean, if you had asked Lou and I when we started writing this book if we thought that we were going to run across instances where it was the difference between life and death, I think we both would have said you were overdramatic, if not hysterical, because we're mostly dealing with stuff like, you know, subsection 23, article 22 of the Interstate Dilly-Dally Compact. But we did find some cases where it was life and death. One of them was in food inspection. The poultry and meat processors of the country are mostly in the red states, and they tend to be big Republican givers. And the Clinton administration had been thinking of putting in new standards for meat and poultry inspection instead of the old poke and sniff method, which is literally what we're still using. They were going to do microbial testing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, when Bush came in, he put the kibosh on that. And one consequence was a fatal outbreak of listeriosis that killed 8 people on the East Coast 2 summers ago. As I say, that sounds terribly dramatic. It even sounds to me a little overdramatic, as I tell you, but that's exactly what happened.
And you've poked it here on the environment front, on the food safety front, right across the board, and found those changes. You say they're made because Bush is putting basically representatives of the corporate world into regulatory positions.
Oh, to an extent, that's just extraordinary. I mean, we've all heard the old saw about the fox guarding the hen coop. I mean, this is just beyond absurd. You know, former lobbyists for corporate special interests being put in charge of the public policy regulating or affecting those industries. I mean, it would be hard to get more egregious, to use a fancy word.
We're talking to Molly Evans tonight. Her new book is Bushwhacked, Life in George W. Bush's America. You can join the conversation. If she's wrong about Bush, where is she wrong? And if she's right about the president, why don't we hear more such criticism in the media? We're at 1-800-423-8255. John's calling from Orleans, Massachusetts. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. I think that the major point is that I wish to make is that under Bush, we have government by deception. He campaigned as a moderate. He governs from the extreme right. There was a plan. There had to have been a plan cooked up by his corporate backers to have him campaign in that way, because the American people never would have bought his package if they'd known what it was. And there's continued deception now. The CIA was saying before the Iraq War that Saddam did not pose a WMD threat. The Patriot Act was sold as fighting terrorism. Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, it's being used to fight to gut the criminal laws. They can get a lot of criminal convictions.
So John, the president's poll numbers have been dropping, but they bumped back up last week. They're above 50%. Are you saying that he's supported because people don't understand what's really going on? Or is it possible that people just like the cut of his jib, even if Molly Ivins doesn't?
Well, they don't know what the cut of his jib is because of the public relations program that the White House has going for it.
It's wrapped around him. Got it. Molly Ivins, what do you say?
Well, I think he's right. The extent to which there has been deception on taxes, on Iraq, on one major issue after another is really quite striking. And beyond the normal political spin, which I'm accustomed to and I don't really barely ever raises an eyebrow with me, been very troubled about the extent to which I really do think, look, Bush ran as a compassionate conservative, which I think we all took to mean that he was a sort of a moderate fellow, as Republicans go.
He would have a humble foreign policy.
That's what he said. That's what he said. And we really have not, boy, have we not asked for what we got from this administration. And I tell you, I really think, I watched Bush for a long time, and in every area of his life that he's gone into, he's chosen an older male mentor, sometimes more than one, and normally chooses quite well. He had him in the oil business, he had Richard Rainwater in finance, he had the late Lieutenant Governor of Texas, Bob Bullock, in Texas politics. This time he chose Dick Cheney, and I think it was, I think this may be the first time he's made a really bad pick. I'm a great believer as a political reporter in the oldest of all rules, which is look at the record, look at the record, look at the record.
But Dick Cheney worked for George Bush's father. George Bush's father turns out to be a very different kind of man than George W. Bush,
That's
at least
true.
where foreign policy comes in. So,
You know, Cheney is much more the senior partner in the relationship with W. than he was with his old man, and he's not. Was not then in such a policy-setting position. And I really think that Cheney is extremely conservative because you can go back and look at his record. And that, I think, is part of what's happened to Bush in Washington. The other thing I suspect is that they've made the most elementary of all political errors, which is they're only listening to each other. They've set up a closed loop between Rumsfeld and Cheney and Wolfowitz and instead of listening to people outside the loop, which is one of the most dangerous and stupid mistakes you can make in politics.
Though the president has spoken up recently and made that a kind of point of pride that he's not reading the newspapers, he's listening to the people around him who know what's going on. But let me ask you this, and John kind of referred to it, but this issue of Bush's level of support. I mean, he had about half the country in the last election. His poll numbers at the end of last week were back up to 56%.
Well,
if he's so bad, why the numbers?
That seems to me entirely explicable. You know, we always rally around the president in times of crisis. As Lyndon Johnson himself used to remind us, I'm the only president you've got. And, of course, after September 9th, we all rallied. I mean, we were ready to do anything. All of us, you know, sign up for the Marines, give blood, get out of our cars and ride bikes, whatever. He could have asked us anything. Unfortunately, all he asked us to do was shop.
But even on the other side of the two wars, the tax cuts, the job losses, the economy. He's still got those numbers, Molly.
Well, you know, okay, September 11th followed by two wars. And I think you are now seeing a sea change. I really think that people are looking up, looking around and saying, wait a minute, this is not going well.
Keith is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Keith, you're on the air.
Oh, thanks a lot. I just want to first thank Molly Ivins because though I tend to be conservative and generally a Bush supporter, listening to her in the last half hour, I think I've learned a lot and I found what she had to say very easy to swallow and not offensive, and I wanted to thank her for that. And
wonderful thing to say.
And thanks. I just wanted to comment quickly on you asked why we don't hear more criticism like this. It seems like most of the other media is fascinated with more glamorous stories like so-and-so doing drugs or Cheney's tenuous financial connections to Halliburton, while these really crystal clear things that you almost might call wrongdoing seem to go unnoticed. And I wish that there'd be more focus placed on things like that so we could become aware of it as listeners to the news.
Keith, we've got it, and thank you very much for your call. Molly Ivins, you're
an excellent caller.
Well, a gentleman who likes what you've got to say, even though he supported Bush.
Exactly.
But what about this issue? You're pretty tough on the Washington Press yourself.
Let me jump right in on the media bashing, one of my favorite things to do. I suffer from a condition called professionocentrism, which is a word I made up myself.
Professionocentrism, all right.
Which means that I hold my profession, journalism, such as it is, if it can even be called a profession, responsible for most of the world's ills. I mean, I really think if we did a better job, the world would be a much better run place. And to me, one of the most astonishing indictments of the American media is this figure that 70% of Americans believe that Saddam Hussein was behind September 11th, which actually the administration has never even directly claimed. It may have implied it or linked it.
Hints and winks and nudges.
Mm-hmm. But nobody ever said that. And what an appalling job we have done of informing people. 70% of the people believe that.
So that may be a lapse in getting something across, but you're more critical than that. You describe the Washington media as kind of courtier circle, sucking up to the president, or at least filing off the hard edges for him. Why would the media do that?
Well, in Washington, the game is access. The Bush administration is very good at playing this game. If you criticize the administration, if you do a story they don't like, they cut you off, and then the important officials won't talk to you. And the game with the
so it's just fear that they're just yellow. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, this goes way back. And it's also there is an element in the Washington Press Corps of high school, of like running around buzz talking about what Mary and Johnny did last night. It's just the most important thing in the whole world, and they lose perspective. I mean, it's just astonishing.
But ultimately, their standing comes from what they do for the country, doesn't it? I mean, the American people want to know what's going on in the final analysis.
Well, how much real news are you getting when, the media of this country spent an entire year devoted to Monica Lewinsky while two-thirds of the world's economy collapsed? I assure you, in the larger scheme of things, it was the collapse of the Asian economies that mattered most to us.
More than Monica. But I guess the question is, beyond the need for access, do you see the media somehow as intimidated? This gets back to your F-word analysis, your fascist analysis. Is it an intimidated media today?
I don't think so. I think it's more that blackbird phenomenon. Washington seems to me a city where everybody says exactly what everybody else says. And what really drives me crazy is that when I go to Washington, instead of saying, y'all, I am fresh in from the prairies of Texas and you're just full of it, I'm not there more than 10 minutes before I find myself saying exactly what everybody else says. That's why I avoid Washington.
So Molly Ivins stays in Texas and maybe gets a clear view of the world. Molly, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight with nationally syndicated columnist Molly Ivins. Her new book is Bushwhacked, Life in George W. Bush's America. She's co-written it with Lou DeBose. You can join the conversation tonight. Is this just payback for Republican Clinton bashing or a right-on critique of George W. Bush? And if President Bush is so bad, why are his poll numbers headed back up? Why didn't the Democrats trounce him in 2000? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with progressive Texan and national columnist Molly Ivins about her former governor and the nation's president, George W. Bush. She's out with a new book, Bushwhacked, Life in George W. Bush's America. You can join the conversation. Molly Ivins is tough on George W. Bush. Has Molly Ivins got it right? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Lee's calling from Southbrook, Maine. Hi, Lee. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom and Molly. It's a treat to get to talk to you. I am spitting mad. I'm an educator, and I think that Bush has really done some terrible things for education, exporting the Texas miracle. But I'm also spitting mad at Congress and the Senate, and because I think they've really caved. And I'm wondering if you're mad about that, too. And I'll take the answer off the air.
Got it, Lee. Thanks for calling. Molly.
Lee, I have to confess, I have some guilt on this. When Lou and I wrote our book about W in 2000, called Shrub, We gave him credit as governor for at least trying on education. We thought he was concerned. We thought he was knowledgeable. It's true the thing he tried to do that would have helped most, which was to get a better tax structure in this state, didn't go anywhere. But we thought he had some good ideas, and even though we had doubts about the charter schools and a few other of his enthusiasms, we gave him pretty high marks on education. What has happened since is that the whole notion of the Texas education miracle has become completely unraveled. It turns out the downside of state test scores going up is so does the dropout level. What Texas is doing is literally forcing kids out of school to keep the scores up. It is the dropout rate has reached 40% in some areas.
Wow.
And it's really appalling. There is a thing they're doing now in some of the Houston high schools where you have to take the test in the 10th grade. Well, they know they've got 9th graders who aren't going to make it. So they remain technical 9th graders for 3 years and then never graduate.
Is Texas reconsidering, Molly Ivins?
Oh, Texas is just screaming at this point. And, of course, the Leave No Child Behind Act, so winsomely named, is producing the same effect all across the country. You're hearing people who, you know, thought that George Bush was pretty much the toast of the town, saying, wait a minute, we can't do this. You can't ask schools to do a better job with no additional resources. And, of course, that was the fatal error in the Leave No Child Behind deal. Ted Kennedy compromised with the president and said, okay, you do your standards, and we'll, let's get some more money in this system. And then W didn't fully fund the program.
And
he's done that time and again.
And what about Lee's question about the Congress and their cooperation with President Bush?
Well, as for the Democrats, there is a technical state-of-the-art term that those of us in the political sciences use. Mm. It's called gutlessness. And I've never seen a poor performance by politicians. It seems to me that it's been clear for a long time that this guy is not, in many cases, not dealt in good faith. And the Leave No Child Behind Act is just one instance of that.
How do you interpret that across the whole Congress? What's brought on the affliction?
The tidal wave of gutlessness that, that is affecting
if
our
that's,
leaders.
If that's what it
well,
is.
That's exactly what it is.
Well, then why? Why now? Why with this president? Why behind this agenda?
I think it's the people, not the president. I mean, you know, Paul Wellstone had no hesitation standing up and saying, wait a minute, this is all wrong. Well, all you need is people with the guts to do it. It doesn't take rocket science or an extra gene or anything like that.
So is it that everybody is in the campaign finance system, so the system kind of generically produces candidates not likely to push harder?
Certainly that's one reason. As I say, the corruption, the buying out by money and interest is a bipartisan phenomenon.
It still makes me wonder, when you get poll numbers like this, you've got the Congress you're saying is gutless, you know, how can it be that things are set up in such a way, if it's as bad as you say, that the whole country, i.e. in the polls, in the voting booth at least half, and in the Congress is kind of going along?
Well, I really don't see it that way. I think there is an actual sea change going on out there. I think people are starting to make the connections. And I think they are starting to see that, you know, this guy told us that we had to go to war because there were weapons of mass destruction. We can't find any. Hey, what's going on? And now we're stuck with all this big bill for rebuilding the country? I mean, I think it becomes clear to people.
There's a lot of unease there. Scott's calling from Wakefield, Massachusetts. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I just have one comment. Molly seems to think that Mr. Bush is really not such a bad fellow, just somewhat misguided. But that being the case, I just wonder how she would explain that during the run-up to the Iraqi invasion, as I understand it, certain companies, some with ties to people in the administration, were allowed to position themselves to make huge financial gains as a result of this invasion.
You think George Bush is more devious than you're hearing Molly Ivins describe tonight?
Oh, absolutely. I think he's probably one of the most corrupt people, perhaps maybe the most corrupt president we've ever had. I think other presidents perhaps were labeled with corruption, Grant, Harding being a couple, but I don't think they were personally corrupt. I have the feeling that Mr. Bush is personally corrupt.
Well, let's pick it up. Scott, thanks for your call. Molly, there's a slow pitch with a lot of spin. What do you say?
All right. Well, Scott, I really think that the no-bid contracts are an absolute scandal. But I think it goes back to, you know, as we say in Texas, of people like Bush, he thinks his own stuff doesn't stink. I've never seen anyone so careless of the appearance of impropriety, and it's all over. It's beyond just the Halliburton and Bechdel contracts. It's, you know, his former top guy, Joe Albaugh from Texas, setting up a firm to advise and consult on how to get a contract in Iraq. And why? Nobody had the presence of mind to say, my God, that looks terrible.
Molly, oh, we only got a minute left. If the country stays on this track, where's it headed? Paint the picture. What does this administration want, to your mind?
Well, I frankly think, again, that the most important thing we're losing is our sense that there is a common good. And instead, we're all being reduced to, you know, some fighting over the same kind of spoils, as though there were only so much, you know, one side had to win and the other side had to lose. And I don't believe that's true.
But can it be self-fulfilling, if that's the view coming out of the White House?
Well, sure it can. And I think at this point, there is such a disproportion between the voice of corporate money and the voice of most people, that we really are in danger of losing what I think is the most magnificent political legacy any people ever received. I'm worried to death about it, but I see no reason not to be funny.
So funny, but your reform recipe is campaign finance reform number one.
Public campaign financing. The oldest saying in politics is you got to dance with them what brung you. And what we need to do is fix the campaign financing system so that when people get elected to public office, they don't owe anybody except the people.
And that means public financing of campaigns. Molly Evans, with that, we're out of time. We hope to talk to you again, but thanks so much for being with us tonight.
I really enjoyed it. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Molly Evans is author of the new book, Bushwhacked, Life in George W. Bush's America. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpoint.org and click on forums. In a moment, look back at last October's hunt for the D.C. area sniper. This is On Point. A year after a series of shootings terrorized the Washington, D.C. area, the trial of suspected sniper John Allen Muhammad began today in Virginia Beach. The 42-year-old Muhammad pleaded not guilty to charges he gunned down a man at a Manassas, Virginia gas station, one of 10 people killed during the shooting spree. If convicted, Muhammad could face the death penalty. Pulitzer Prize-winning Washington Post reporter Sari Horowitz has co-authored a new book that looks back at those bizarre weeks last fall when motorists ducked behind their cars while pumping gas and consumers ran in zigzag motion from their cars to the store. Here, Horowitz reads from Sniper, The Hunt for the Killers Who Terrorized the Nation. In this excerpt, local and federal police botch a potential major lead in the search for the sniper.
It was raining on the morning of Monday, October 21st, as Jose Morales walked across the parking lot of a convenience store outside Richmond to call his wife in Guatemala. Morales had entered the United States illegally 5 months earlier. He earned $8 an hour working as a roofer from dawn to dusk and slept on the floor in a crowded apartment with six other immigrants. He had five children back home. Across the street at an Exxon station, Edgar Rivera Garcia, a carpenter from Mexico, was sitting in a white Plymouth minivan with a roof rack, talking on a payphone. He had been on the phone for 35 minutes, parked close enough to the phone kiosk so that it didn't have to get out of the van and get wet. It was 8:32 a.m., and the lives of two immigrants were about to change, and not for the better. Responding to Montgomery County Police Chief Charles Moose's appeal the night before, Lee Boyd Malvo and John Muhammad had indeed called back. 35 minutes before, they had called the Ponderosa Steakhouse in Ashland, Virginia, from a payphone at the same Exxon station where Garcia was talking. Baltimore FBI agent Jackie Dalrymple took the call, which had been automatically forwarded to the Sniper Task Force Command Center in Rockville. Dalrymple had been on duty since 7 a.m. and had already taken several calls on the Ponderosa line. Someone had asked about the chicken wings, someone else about the work schedule that day. When the phone rang at 7:57 a.m., it was Lee Malvo. "Is this the Ponderosa?" Malvo asked. "Who is this?" Dalrymple said. "Don't say anything, but listen," Malvo said. And he started a tape that he was holding next to the phone. "Dearest police, call me God. Do not release to the press. 5 red stars. You have our terms. They are non-negotiable. If you choose option 1, you will hold a press conference stating to the media that you believe you have caught the sniper like a duck in a noose. Repeat every word exactly as you heard it. If you choose option 2, be sure to remember he will not deviate. P.S. Your children are not safe." The call had lasted for 38 seconds. It picked up perfectly from the note found after the Ponderosa shooting. The same code phrases, the stars, the threat to children. No kook could know those details. At 8:03, 6 minutes after Malvo made his call, Marshal Inspector Tim Hine heard about the call from Dalrymple. To Hine, those 6 minutes seemed like 6 hours. With these kinds of calls, every second counts. The slight delay in giving the number to Hine was just the first miscue that morning that would turn opportunity into fiasco. Armed with the number from caller ID and aided by a local phone company, Hine tracked the call to a payphone outside the Exxon station at Parham Road and West Broad Street within minutes. At 8:07, Hine told top FBI and Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms officials where the phone call came from. Hine had also called Lenny DePaul, a New York-based inspector for the marshals who had been brought in on the sniper case for his expertise with fugitives. DePaul was in his car driving toward Richmond. "Going soft," DePaul told Kevin Engel, another marshal who was nearing the Exxon station. At 8:08, Henrico County Police Officer Roger Condrey spotted a man in a white van on a payphone. Garcia. Condrey radioed in what he saw, and the on-scene commander gave the order for the officers to move in. They closed down the streets and secured the gas station. The response was anything but soft. At 8:30, 33 minutes after the Rockville Task Force first got the call, Henrico SWAT officers swept across the parking lot, hauled Garcia out of his Plymouth at gunpoint, and scooped up Morales for good measure. At the Exxon station, Engel had no doubt there had been a mistake. A guy who had been getting away with the crimes of the century wasn't going to be on the payphone for half an hour, he thought. Somebody just screwed up. It turned out there were 2 phones on opposite ends of the Exxon station. The hammer had come down on the wrong one. Garcia and Morales were just unlucky. Neither spoke much English or knew the other. They were released in a few hours, but their problems were just beginning. Within a few months, both would be back in their home countries, technically not deported, but repatriated.
Sari Horowitz, reading from the new book she's co-authored, Sniper, The Hunt for the Killers Who Terrorized the Nation. Horowitz is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for The Washington Post. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Julie Jupp, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Sarah Cook. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.